Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
This is the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I am speaking with one of our elders of our village, a griot, in many, many words, Mr. Earl McCoy Sr. Welcome, yes. Sir.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here.
New Haven born and raised. Tell me a little bit about your childhood and what neighborhoods you grew up in.
Well, I was born in Yale New Haven Hospital, obviously, but I grew up at 556 Valley Street in the McConaughey Terrace housing projects. And I always like to say that was where I got my first degree in the importance of family and friends. It happened right there, and it was me, my two brothers, my mother and father, and my mother and father were just starting out in New Haven. And my cousins lived over the fence on South Genesee, and we were always together as a family. They were more like brothers and sisters to us, like the Grangers and the Sykeses. We were always together every day, no matter what happened. And the family would come from out of town. We'd be in this two-bedroom apartment, and the family would come and they would sleep on our couches and on the floor. And as you go up the stairs, it was a curved step. And sometimes that curved step was where I slept, you know, because there were so many people and it was just so tight in there, you know. But those, I would never guess anything was wrong because it was nothing but love there. And then I did not go to West Hills School down there. No, yes, I did. I went to West Hills School down the hill. And that there was rain, sleet, or snow. We were gone. Mom out the house. My father was working at Pratt and Whitney. And my mother, I think she just got into Southern New England Telephone as an operator, I think, you know, and they were very, very humble beginnings back then.
Your father, what kind of man was he to you, and what kind of values did you get from him?
My father, I have to call him Dad, because he was more than just a father to us. A quick story about him. He played football at Hills High School along with, you probably heard the name Floyd Little. All right. Floyd Little, the way the story was told to me, and Floyd himself told us this, that if my father had never gotten hurt on that football field, he probably might not have heard of Floyd Little. He said, but when my father got hurt, and Floyd got into the game, the play was designed for something else. But Floyd said that he wanted to play. So he called his own play. And he scored a touchdown. And once my father ankle healed up, it was him and Floyd in the backfield together. It was, from what I understand, the greatest duel of running backs that New Haven High School, Hillhouse High School, has ever seen. And my father was a stand-up guy. He never ever said that I can remember that he loved me, but he showed it in every way possible as a man could. You talk about accountability, being there to the best he could. He was there. He was there. That's Pops, you know.
Any good stories with you and your father traveling or a little outing every once in a while?
Good stories with my father. There was a story, me and my brother Hank were outside on this. And this is when we have moved. Nope, I'll stay in the projects here before we go. All right. When we were in the projects, there were some kids that lived next door to us. And my father was very adamant because I had two older brothers. And he would always say to us, you guys are going to grow up and be men one day. Don't let your mother know this, but you could take those guys next door. You know what I mean? He said, there's two of them and three of you. You guys go over there and handle your business. He said, I'm right here if his father got something to say. You know, and he would always give us these boxing gloves to put on. And we would always have to box inside the projects there just to toughen up a little bit, you know. And but that never happened, you know, because we ended up becoming good friends with them, you know. It just how it just how things worked out, you know. And but when we moved, if I could move it up a little bit, if when we moved from McConaughey Terrace over to Diamond Street, that was where I got my second degree, at the University of Jewel Street in the playground of School of Hard Knocks. And that is where I learned about bigotry. And my father, staying with his story, would always say, you know, we're family and we always stick together. He says, we don't run from nobody. And he would come home, and we were the only blacks on that street. And when we would come home, we would go outside and play. You could see the neighbors basically just close their doors, go in the house.
Can I add that you were the first black family to move on to Diamond Street, correct?
We were the first family, first black family on that street. Living next to us on the left side was a Chinese couple called the Changs. And they were very, very nice. They were the only people on that street that would talk to us. Nobody else would talk to us. And when because we went to Beecher Elementary School, and there was a family named the McDonald's. And when we went to school, me and my sister walking to Beecher Elementary School on Jewel Street. They would be outside, and they would consistently yell, Mom, here come the ends. Here come the ends. Mom, the ends are coming. And the mother would come outside and say, you guys get in the house. Let them ends go by. And we would go by, me and my sister. And I got home and I would tell my brothers about it. And we would go down there. But they would never come outside. But then the whole street started getting like that. And now I'm going into maybe the second grade. And I'm saying to myself, why? Why is this? You know, and I'm coming from an all African-American community going into an all-white community. My mother and father, I had that mixture within my family to begin with. But why this element? I just could not understand that. And then to go down to the playground, be on that playground, and they would not let us play on the playground was just unbelievable. You ends gotta wait. You end this. And it wasn't the entire neighborhood, but there was a strong element of grown men down there that would not allow us to play down there. And I'm not getting off subject, am I?
No, you're staying right on it.
All right. And I remember I was still in Beachview Elementary School, and also I had a severe speech impediment where I had to go to speech class up until the sixth grade at Beachview Elementary School. And so it was hard for me to articulate what was going on, but my brothers and them knew because I could tell them. And we went on the playground, and these kids, whoever they came from, were just consistently call us N-words till it came to the point where we're all physically fighting. And every time we did, we were always outnumbered. It was never one-on-one. It was either they probably had 7 to us 3. It was, and I'm talking grown men were getting involved in this. It was just ridiculous. Then we called my cousins, Butch and Troy, Sykes, and they would come over. And I think they might have been in middle school, 7th grade. And they would come over, and we would go down to the park. And we'd be playing. And then these kids would come again. And then when these kids were there, it just seemed like, you know, my cousin, Maurice, I call him, but we call him Butch. His name is Maurice. He wasn't having that. And I remember stuff was going on, and his famous line, he said, he took off that leather coat, and he said that we have to get it on if we're going to get along. And I'm going to tell you something. That cousin of mine, Maurice Sykes, is the closest thing to a black superhero I have ever seen in my life. He was not running. He was not moving. You were not touching my cousins at all. And those grown men, he was knocking out grown men down there on Jewel Street in that playground and in the cemetery, because the playground and the cemetery were right next to him. Everything was going on down there. And the funny part about it was that when school was going on, I didn't see none of these kids in school. I didn't go to school with whoever these kids were in the neighborhood. But when it came time to go to the playground, my mother said, we can go down there. They were always there. Wouldn't let us on the basketball court. And it just kept going and going and going and going until it got to the point where I think my brother Hank and my cousin Butch were on the basketball court. And it was the Jewish kids that lived in that brick apartment. And if you know anything about the Jewish religion, you know, they're not supposed to be acting that way. But
I just want to interrupt real quick before we get into this ball game, because I heard that this is an epic story. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Canelario with Earl McCoy Sr., about to get into the ball games of ball games.
Yeah, so my cousin Butch was down there, and the guys are playing basketball. And my brother Hank was on the court, and one of those Jewish kids, I don't know the name, you have to have my brother remember the name, told my brother to get off the court. And my brother said, no. You know what I mean? And so then my cousin Butch said, the guy said, you got to tell your little brother to get off the court so we can play. And my cousin Butch said, I don't got to tell him nothing. You know what I mean? And my cousin took off his jacket, laid it down, and said, I tell you what, you got a problem with him, you got a problem with me. And the first person that leaps, I'm breaking somebody's jaw. You know, and I think I showed you the picture of him. He said, I'm breaking somebody's jaw. My cousin got the right to be here, and they're going to be here as long as I'm here. And a lot of talking going on, and then me and my older brother would come running up to see what was going on, and somehow it became into, let's play a football game. And okay, so now we decided to have it the following Saturday. So we go home, and one next thing you know, we're calling the families. Mm-hmm. All right. So we reach out to my cousin, Sykes, they all came over. My cousin Ronnie, Derek, and Terry. the Grangers from out the Connecticut Terrace. They came over and they were like, what's going on? We're going to play a football game. And it was really the blacks against the whites. And now it's time to play the game. Me and my brothers, and we come down the field first. It was a sea of white. I mean, I'm not even going to exaggerate. It had to be close to maybe 50, 100 kids down there for a football game. And we walked down there. Then my two cousins come, and my cousins from out McConaughey Terrace and a few of their friends come out there. And when they turned the corner and they all came in, the looks on these kids' eyes were like, where'd he come from? You know, and then this thing, you know, somebody might have called the police because they were down there. Now it's time to play the game. And the first thing that we all got together and said, you know, we're going to play this game. We're going to play it hard. And we're not going to stop until the message is sent. Now, at a young age, I have no idea what that meant, but my cousin said, the message is sent. So now we're playing this football game, and it was epic. There were broken bones, there was blood, there were bodies being picked up and slammed down who weren't even carrying the ball. You know, there were a couple of skirmishes that broke out into this game. Everything got separated. But once the game was over and we won that game, there was no more racial tension down there at all. When we went down to the park the following weekend, we went down there. I remember I went down there and my brother Hank, and it was like, Earl, you want to play ball with us? Yo, I got Earl on my team. You know what I mean? And it was like, all the N-words, now my name's Earl now. But and that's what I meant by my first educational degree in family, the importance of family and friends.
Wow. So yeah. What year is this?
This had to happen. I'm in maybe the third grade. I'm about, what, maybe 8 years old in third grade? So you figure 71.
So this is, we will officially call it the game of 71.
Yeah.
That's what we will call it. Yeah. The game of 71. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC. I'm Jose. And we're talking to Mr. Earl McCoy Sr., who took part in the game in 1971, mm-hmm. right there on Jewel Street in the neighborhood here. Well, I guess we call it Beaver Hills now, but back then it was probably something else.
I think it was still called Beaver Hill, but at the Beecher Elementary School.
At the Beecher Elementary School, right playground. Back there. Yep. I know exactly where you're at.
Yeah, it looked totally different back then.
Oh, of course.
Than it does now. Yeah.
So you're growing up in New Haven and mm-hmm. some tough times. What was your experience in high school and moving forward, middle school and high school?
Middle school was great. I have to admit, I enjoyed middle school. I made a lot of friends. My athletic ability started to kick in from being able to now run around the playground with all ease and play with all the these older kids. And I was very fleet of foot back then. I could always hit a baseball far and kick a kickball far. And I remember I signed up to play for Andy Papero Baseball League in Westville. And in tryouts, I was knocking a ball all over the fence. And then it came to being on the team. I played for 95 House. And me and Scott X, the NAACP president, that's where I met him at, right there. And, you know, we were the only two African-Americans on that team. And we were playing, and I'm going to tell you something. My father would come to the games, and I would strike out every time. And I remember my father saying to me, why am I going to come to the games just to see you strike out? It stayed with me till present day, you know. And then Dougie Fortune, who was a professional baseball player, was a coach up there. And I remember him telling me to stay with it. Good things are going to happen. People peak at different times in their lives. This was my first time ever playing organized ball. I signed up all by myself. I tried it, and I wanted to stay with it. And I did not make the All-Star team. Did not make it. Then the next half of the season came along. And boy, did I rip that league apart at that point. You know, everybody knew who I was then. I guess it just took the timing down and throwing people out and stealing the bases. I started to make a name for myself. And I remember I got my name in the newspaper and, you know, I went 2 for 3. And I said, Dad, look. Couldn't get him off the stands after that. Mom and Pop were always there after that, you know. And then I left there and I tried out for Emmons Bone Babe Ruth League for the 13-year-olds. And I played for Whaley Glass, the Palmieri family. And it just clicked from there. You know, I was very good into baseball. And I played it all through high school. I made All-State in baseball in high school. I made All-State in indoor track. And I made All-State in soccer in high school. I'm also, my father and I, to present day, are the only father and son to ever be elected into the prestigious Hills High School Athletic Hall of Fame. And I had a great high school career. I met a lot of, and I mean friends, you know, during my elementary school, my middle school years, and following them all through high school, and we're still connected, still to present.
Community is different because what you're explaining to me is family and friends. Community now is different. What has changed over time, or what do you feel is not the same?
I think one, technology. I think technology got in the way of kids going outside and playing and getting to know your neighbor and talking with each other. I think that now, to me, is a lost art. People want to grab their phones and text, you know, and they're going to say that I still, to this day, I'm calling somebody. I got to talk to a person. It means more to me. I got to hear your voice. I think that got into a way of it, a lot of it. And just trying to get a group of kids together to play a kickball game or a basketball game is hard because they all want to go on there. I forgot what they call those computer games because I don't, you know, they all want to go on there and play and thumb it all night long. I think that has a lot to do with everything. And they seem to think that, you know, these are games, but in those games, you know, those characters die in those games and then they come back to life. But you can't do that in real life. You're talking about real human beings. You got to be able to talk to see what's going on. I like to always say, and I pass this on to my kids, I always use the philosophy deal, D-E-A-L. Before I make any judgment and do anything, I always like to diagnose the situation, evaluate it, act upon it, and then leverage the learning to make it a win-win for everybody. Because that's the only way that we're going to coexist as people. If we have to dialogue. And I think that's becoming, communication becoming a lost art.
Yeah, I wish I could agree or disagree, but I'm going to be abstained from this judgment. Athletics has evolved. I mean, we have put out a lot of phenomenal athletes. You named a few already. Wilbur Cross put out NBA players in the past. What has devolved in our athletics program that we're now not putting out those type of caliber individuals?
Well, I think growing up like we did, we played every sport. You know, we went from track to soccer to baseball to football. Now everything is so specialized. All the kids want to, I'm just going to stay with this. And this only, and the AA, if I'm saying it right.
AAU.
Yep. The AAU are now starting to take kids from areas and that should be going to this school and they end up going over here. It tends to break up the chemistry of the kids being together from freshman year to high school years. And them and the coaches will consistently send them to whatever soccer clinics all year round. Whereas, well, what about track? What about baseball and all the other sports that I can't seem to think of right now? It's just too specialized into one area, in my opinion. Let them all play them all to see what they're good at, and let them enjoy their youth.
Let's skip a little bit because, you know, time is of the essence. You professionally, you also worked at Southern New England Telephone for a time.
I like to say that I got my associate's degree in communication at Southern Connecticut State. No, at Southern Connecticut, okay. At Southern New England Telephone. And I got my bachelor's degree in public relations at SBC. But I got my master's degree in diversity, equity, and inclusion at the University of AT&T. But I got my doctoral degree in belonging at Frontier Communication. And when I worked at Southern New England Telephone, when I came in, I was making, this is back in 1986, and I was married, and I had my first daughter, Essence. And also, I must say that while in Hillhouse High School, I met my wife in the sophomore year in high school, and we've been married ever since, coming up on 37 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we have three wonderful kids, Essence Durkin, she's married, Elise Williams, that's my middle daughter, and my son Earl Jr. And six wonderful grandkids. But while working at Southern New England Telephone Company, I was in the mailroom. I delivered mail throughout the company, make $189.50 a week. And my supervisor named George Durso said to me that I don't belong in the mailroom. You belong outside with the guys. And I went on a ride with a technician, and I love what he did, and I transferred outside. Now, here's where my first degrees in family, the importance of family and friends, and bigotry come into play. Because while I'm in Southern New England Telephone, I got put with a guy who did not like people of color. And the manager knew it. And this guy I was with showed me everything wrong to do. Then when I went into the training center to learn, the instructors were like, well, why are you doing the wiring like that? Here's the wiring code. Well, this is how I was shown how to do it. No. This is how we do it here. So now when I left school, I had to go right back with the same guy. Even though the instructor told my manager that the guy was showing me the wrong stuff to do. Now I'm doing my work, I'm getting it right, and his job was to make sure when I left that everything was the way it's supposed to be. Well, while I'm talking to the customer and filling out the logbook, he would go back and sabotage something in the house, which would generate what we call a repair ticket for another tech to come out. Now, unbeknownst to me, because I didn't know anything about unions and stuff, I just know that I'm outside with the guys, got along with most of them. I was the only African-American there in that garage of about maybe 50. And one day, I remember my supervisor called me over and said, Earl, he put a stack of papers on that desk and said, this is the amount of money you have cost the company because of the heavy, they call repeaters, going back. Now, I know in my heart of heart, I fixed those jobs. I know I did because the customers were there. Now, he says, you're going back to the mailroom starting tomorrow. Do not come in here. And I'm like, oh, now here I am telling my wife that we're going to eventually get together, move out, because they had a lot of overtime. I go back and tell her that I'm going back to $189.50 a week with my daughter sitting there. And I went home. I called my mother and father up. I told them because I was trying to get that reassurance. But the answer I was looking for just didn't come there. I hung the phone up. And then we were living on 82 Dickerman Street. We had the state police blocking the streets because of the Latin Kings. And I had to show proof that I lived there every time I came home. And this is how I know that there is a God. Because this was about 9:30 at night. I truly believe God dispatched his angel to my apartment to correct the wrong and make it right. And he came like a beacon of light in the night. He came to that door, he rang that doorbell, and it was last name McCoy, and there were three McCoys on that doorbell. He hit my grandmother's doorbell. My grandmother came to that door, opened it, and she sicked the German Shepherd on that man. And he was holding the door back, and she was yelling to me to come downstairs. And I said, what's wrong? And this is my grandmother talking. She said, Earl, there's some fat white man at the door trying to get in. And I'm looking down, and I look out the window, and I see a SNET Chevette. Now, in the back of my mind, I'm saying, how do you know I took that screwdriver? You know, that's what came to my mind. And I come downstairs, and I'm like, yo, what's going on? He said, Earl, yeah? Hey, I'm so-and-so. I'll tell you his name in a minute. He said, can I talk to you? I said, what for? Well, you had some type of problem at the job, and, you know, I want to hear about it. I said, is that your Chevette out there? He said, yeah. He showed me his phone company badge. I put the dog away. We go upstairs. He sat down in the living room, and he says, so tell me, you know, what happened? I said, I don't know. I come in one day, and the supervisor showed me this stack of papers, and he's telling me I got to come back there. And he said, do you think, and he's rubbing his skin, you think there was a problem there? And I said, well, I know I was put with a guy who did not like me because of the color of my skin. That much I know. And he said, Earl, I'll never forget this. He said, Earl, I'm going to tell you something. I'm not going to use my words to describe your situation. I'm going to use my words to change your situation. Tomorrow morning, you report right back to that Hamden garage. And you tell Louis Landino, who was my supervisor, that I will see him at 10 o'clock. And don't you tell nobody that what happened here tonight. He said, but everybody's going to know that you left and are going back, and they should. So I go back to the garage. I walk in the room, and everybody knew I was gone. Earl, what you doing here? Well, some guy came to my door and told me to come here to meet with Louis. You know, and I'm like, okay. And okay. So I'm sitting in the waiting room. A supervisor comes in. Earl, what you doing here? I said, some guy came to my house and told me to wait here. He wants to come see you at 10 o'clock. He said, who? I said, some guy named Eddie Correll. Eddie Correll? Yeah, Eddie Correll. He came to your apartment 9:30 last night. Told me to come here and tell you he'll be at 10 o'clock. Louis dismissed everybody. He brought me to my truck that I had, the old Rangers. He opened up the back of my truck and all the tills, took out all my old stuff I had. Started giving me all these brand new Makita drills and setting it up nice for me. Eddie Correll came in. I said, hey, Earl, I want you to sit outside here. He closed the door. I never heard so many F-bombs being thrown around in there. And I remember it was all over. He called me in there, and he said, Earl, Louis is your supervisor. He will be your supervisor. If you have any problem, from this day forward, here's my card, here's my home number. You call me, and you call me right away as it's happening. I said, okay. And he said, by the way, you're going to be assigned a technician, two of them really, that will be assigned to you for the next 5 years to help you through to get caught up to speed. And those two technicians, one was Eddie Lennon. I'm not afraid to say name because it's true. And Dave Trotter. And those guys are probably the reason why I'm still employed now, because of what they did. And once that word got out about what happened, that whole garage there seemed to rally around me, because of that. I like always like to say bad apples will fall by themselves, you know, and, you know, all of a sudden the culture just changed.
You're listening to the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City, and Mr. Earl McCoy Sr., an elder in our village, sharing his experiences in diversity and inclusion for the first time ever, most likely, at SNET, a mantle that your son has taken on in his life. Who would have known that you, who have benefited from an individual who championed for you, that he's now doing the same? What does it mean to have people champion for you in your life and step up? And how do you put that into your current work?
Well, I just want to say this too about Mr. Correll. You know, he corrected a wrong and made it right. And 2 weeks after he did this, he suffered a massive heart attack on the Woodbridge golf course and died. That was my support system. He was gone now. Now I'm left at the mercy of whatever's going to happen. But because of what he did and stuff he put in writing, you know, I just made it a point to, from now on, if I have any issues, I want to get in front of the stockholders and gatekeepers who run this company. I want to meet the presidents of the company. And I've met them all, and they are all great people. And some of them I'm still in contact with today. And I have put on many diversity programs within the Bell system. And I've also was the first African-American president of the Black Community Network, which is the African-American Telecommunications Professionals of, I think we were going into SBC, AT&T at the time. And right then and there was where my diversity program was born, you know. And to have my son has come to a lot of those programs, and he's been in the audience, and I think he might have rubbed off on him a little bit, you know.
Just a tad.
And I always say, when I grow up, I want to be just like him, you know. He's far exceeded my reach, but within my reach, I met some great people.
Tell me a little bit about your nonprofit work and what the name of it is. And you just did just have an event where you brought a pilot to speak to the youth.
Yep. My nonprofit is called Making a Difference Foundation, and I started that back in, I want to say 1999 or 2000. It was on the turn right there. And, you know, I wanted to get involved with the school system because I was delivering a program called Choices that my wife and I made up. And we delivered it some at Wilbur Cross High School, over at Hillhouse High School, Hyde High School, and Eli Whitney. And my wife and I would go there. We would bring guest speakers from out of town, and they would come in there and talk about the importance of school, education, and their life stories. Because how can you be something if you don't know what something is? So while I was doing that, because this is important, and I will get to that pilot, but while I was doing that, remember, I still have young children I'm raising. I was taking a lot of my time. And I remember my oldest daughter said to me, "Dad, you missed my track meet." And when she said that, it hit me very hard. And I pretty much stopped it because I did not want to be that type of father to miss their stuff. And I stopped it. And now I just recently picked it back up. Okay. And I was looking at the magazine of a bunch of African-American pilots. And I'm looking at it. And I said, wait a minute. I got a cousin who's a pilot. So I called him up and said, hey, would you mind coming to school and talking to some middle school kids about being a pilot and things like that? And he said, yeah, cuz, sure, I got no problem with that. So he came in from New Jersey, Elijah Johnson. He's an American airline pilot. He came into that school. I spoke with the ladies there, and they said they'd love to have him. And he came in, and he spoke to the kids. And I'm going to tell you something. They were totally amazed at seeing a black pilot, a real black pilot. And
I'll be honest with you. The last one I saw was the Tuskegee Airmen.
Wow.
So to see a commercial airline pilot, that, I mean, to show children that that is an actual option for their career.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he did. He said that he started at a young age. I mean, I think he's only, I want to say 26, 25, I think. Mm. And he started at a young age. He took his first solo flight. I think he might have said when he was maybe 16, you know, flew this. He had to fly around somewhere, he did, and he did all by himself. And then he got hooked up into the commercial airlines, and you know, he flies for American Airlines right now. And but he came to that school, and he dressed up in that outfit with the hat on and walked up in there with the picture of the pilot. Kids loved him, and they want him to come back. And we're gonna bring him back. And when he comes back, he's going to come back with a female black pilot.
There you go. You're doing so much for our community. We're wrapping this up. What are your final words to the people out there who are listening in right now?
My final words is you have to believe in yourself because nobody else will. A lot of people are going to tell you that you can't do something, but that's because they can't do it. Stay true to yourself, believe in yourself, and everything will work itself out because the sun will come up tomorrow.
Thank you so much. This has been a conversation with Earl McCoy Sr. Thank you very much for your time, sir. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. And like always, thank you for your listen.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.